Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of thepaleomom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Stacey, how are you? It feels like a million years ago since we last recorded a podcast because I was in a different country last week.
Well, I am wonderful. It's rainbows and butterflies for me because I'm in complete denial about the show topic. And so I'm just super excited.
I just thought since we did a check-in show last week that we should...
That you want it to be the grossest, most technical, detailed show possible? Is that what you're about to tell me?
I just thought it would be fun to make you a little uncomfortable, is what I thought. Right before we hang out in person next week, you know, let's just rip off some Band-Aids a little bit.
I'll have you know that there will be so much toilet humor next week. As a result of the show, I'm going to be asking you on a regular basis if you are preparing for a colonoscopy as you are getting ready in the bathroom.
Okay. Done. You know what I actually think is going to happen, even though we're staying in the same house for Paleo FX? I think I'm not going to see you for the whole conference. Having a look at your schedule, having a look at my schedule, I'm like, wow, these don't overlap at all.
Yeah, I was going over
that. You're really busy.
I was going over my schedule with Monica, and the time that was scheduled for me to do my cooking demo is actually when I'm supposed to be headed to the airport. So we're trying to figure out if I can do that or if I need to reschedule. But the only time to reschedule is when we'd planned to have a brunch. And so I'm like really torn and frustrated about the schedule right now.
So that actually happened to me and I did change my flight to go back Monday morning. So I had thought, oh, you know, like I'm there for the whole conference. I'm there from Thursday afternoon on. Like, it's going to be fine. I'll just have to leave like 45 minutes early on Sunday. Like, no big deal. The conference will be winding up. I'll just miss the last session. And then I'm in the last session on Sunday. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'm staying one more night and figuring that logistics out. And I changed my flight. So I will be, oddly enough, I will be everywhere and nowhere all at once.
Well, that is not an option for me, so I am trying to figure out how we can manage. But for those listening to the podcast, Sarah and I, at this very moment, as you're listening to it, will be together in some fashion or other.
We're not. This podcast is going to...
Thursday night. I'm going to be there Thursday night.
You're going to be there next Thursday night.
Oh, duh.
We have a whole other podcast between...
Yeah.
This podcast and the podcast that's going to air while we're at Paleo FX. But now is an excellent time to remind people that there are some tickets left if they think they want to do a last minute trip to Austin. And also an excellent time to remind people that I think at least two of the stages are going to have free live web streams. So you can actually watch all of the talks, or maybe three of them. So they're doing the cooking demos are going to be live. So you can watch those. Just like you sign up and we'll put those links in the show note and then you can watch them live on the internet. And then also I know for sure the keynote stage because my talk is going to be live on Sunday. So if you can't go, you can use the interwebs to watch it for free, which is cool.
Yep.
That's all you got is just, yep.
Well, I was going to add, and you can do it for free, but you did that. So what am I supposed to add?
Woot, woot, would have been good.
if you come to Austin, there are also a whole bunch of events and stuff. It's not just talks, by the way. And they do have expo tickets, which are much more affordable for people who might be interested. Sarah and I will both be doing book signings at PaleoFX, and also both of us have one scheduled separately for offsite at PaleoFX. So
that must be weird. We're not doing one together.
It's
both like doing one the same night, and they're not together.
It's an alternate universe of weirdness. But so if people are interested in that kind of stuff but can't afford the full ticket price, it is. I think that the vendor expo is totally worth the price of the tickets because you get to network, and that's where most of the bloggers hang out. That's where the food panel, I mean, the food demo stuff usually is.
I don't know if they're going to have it set up the same as last year, but last year they had one of the stages in the expo area as well. So you could actually see some of the talks. They like the keynote stage and the mastermind stage are like, those are that where they generally put the, I want to say big shots, the Rob Wolfs and the Mark Sissons, those people. Do we have a good name for those people?
They're called keynote speakers.
Keynote speakers. The Rob Wolfs and the Mark Sissons and those people.
Well,
those stages are in a separate area because they seat a lot more people.
And then they do have the movement sessions usually in that area too. So you might even possibly be able to still sign up for like a movement seminar. Like I am signed up to lift with Jen Sinclair because, you know, obviously.
Because you have a girl crush on Jen Sinclair.
Obviously.
And so, who doesn't, really?
I'm terribly mortified, though, that her session is at the same time as Melissa Jewell and Stephanie Gaudreau. Like, the struggle was real with figuring out my schedule. So, but I had to go with Sinclair because I was planning all along to lift with her. So, those kinds of things, I think, are options for people if they want to still come but not buy the full admission price of all the fancy lectures.
And you could sit there with your smartphone in the expo and watch the talk streaming live from the keynote stage upstairs. Totally don't say the organizers that I just came up with that idea, but I did. I just came up with that idea.
I don't even know what's wrong with you.
No, because like that's like the cheatingest way to attend, but it just occurred to my brain, and so I thought I'd share it.
All right, so I was totally wrong about the dates, but I do want to mention that this weekend, we, Matt and I, have book signings in Frederick, Maryland, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at Costco's. So come out, meet us. We would like to sign your books. We would love for you to buy both Eat Like a Dinosaur and Beyond Bacon are available at the book signings that we do at Costco, and they're the cheapest that you can find them, even on Amazon. So signed books make great gifts, and we'd love to meet you. What are these dates? April 18th and 19th at Frederick, Maryland, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hope to see you.
That sounds awesome. I didn't realize you guys were doing book signings like the week before traveling for PaleoFX. That's hardcore.
Yeah, we did signings last weekend too. Because somebody doesn't learn lessons.
Right.
And, well, actually, honestly, I was thinking, I just came back from vacation and, you know, they're just driving tours and we'll do them with the whole family. And it probably would have been fine if I didn't have like work craziness and personal stress happening. But I could really use like a down weekend, and unfortunately that's not happening for a while, but I will be all right. Keeping my positivity
you'll be good
flowing.
For May. You've got one at least in May planned, presumably.
Actually, May's really... Anyway.
Okay.
June. I'm planning on visiting.
Planning on having one weekend off in June.
Yeah, pretty much that's how it's looking. And I'm really excited. I'm going to go visit Danielle out in San Francisco before she has her baby. That's like, I'm going to hold on to that nugget for a while. So I'm going to plan that.
Okay. That's pretty awesome. That's epic, actually. So do you want to talk about poop?
You can talk about poop.
I
have never had some of the problems that we're going to talk about. So it's all you, sister.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. We invite our listeners to ask us questions, and sometimes they ask us questions that involve poop, and we would be doing our listeners a disservice to never answer these questions because one of the co-hosts of this podcast doesn't like talking about poop.
I just want to put out there that there's a lot of things that I don't like talking about.
Okay.
It's not like I just have a problem with poop. I'm just kind of uncomfortable. I don't know why, because I'm super vulgar about so many other things, but there are just some things that give me the skeebie-jeebies. I don't know. Like, I'm just, you should see the face that I'm making over here. I'm like scrumpling up my face and making like little witch hand things. Like, I don't want to talk about poop, but gonna do it. Gonna do it for the listeners. And it is super important.
That you are absolutely a conundrum.
I know. It's so weird. I also am really uncomfortable talking about the thing that we didn't talk about the other week. What did your doctor say? What call it?
What? Sense of well-being.
Sense of well-being is also something that I'm totally not comfortable talking about. Like, I highly encourage everyone to have that aspect of their life, but it is not for me to discuss with them. I'm just weird. I'll admit it. So anyway, I do agree with you that it would be a disservice, and it is something that I personally research and talk to friends in code words about, because it's a very, very good sign of health and that sort of thing. So I understand. I'm just going to plug up my ears and focus on this treadmill desk situation while you geek out about poop.
Excellent. So I actually think what's really, really ironic about that entire discussion right now is I think poop is actually going to be quite tangential to the current topic, which is actually more technically colonoscopies. We actually had like a crazy collection of colonoscopy related questions in our inbox. So it's like the colonoscopy show, but I'm not sure you can talk about colonoscopies and not talk about poop. So there's that.
Give me some science.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So because we're talking about colonoscopies, to me, that made me think about the main reason why people get colonoscopies is potential or symptoms that might indicate diseases of the colon. And one of the most common that people are looking for is polyps or colon cancer. And so when we're talking about a paleo diet and colonic health, and we're talking about, you know, risk of colon cancer, it's one of those actually really common question that comes up about the paleo diet is like, isn't all that meat going to cause cancer? And it's an interesting question because the literature linking meat and cancer risk is actually strongest for colon and rectal cancer. So it becomes something where, you know, the standard I think fairly flippant reply to that, I think, legitimate question is, oh, well, those studies are done in grain-fed meat and we eat grass-fed meat, and so it's healthier for you, so it doesn't happen. And that's not an accurate reply, because the studies that are starting to actually tease out the mechanisms behind the link between meat and cancer are not linking the fats in the meat with cancer, which is the dominant aspect that is different between grain-fed meat and grass-fed meat. They're actually linking the protein in meat. And the protein, while grass-fed meat is more protein dense, the actual different types of protein in those meats is not appreciably different. So what's really interesting to understand is where the links between meat consumption and cancer interact with other factors. So there is actually a fairly large body of literature linking meat, especially red meat, and cured meats, but red meat separately, consumption. The more you eat of that, the higher risk of colon cancer. But one of the things that's really important to understand is that when you eat a lot of vegetables and fruits, when you correct for somebody who eats a lot of meat but also eats a lot of vegetables and fruits, that correlation just completely disappears. Now, what's interesting is that as we start to understand the mechanisms behind why red meat in particular may increase cancer risk, we also need to understand, like, why would eating vegetables negate that? So there's three main mechanisms behind how red meat is linked to cancer. One is it's the iron protein called heme. It's an iron-based protein. It's actually what hemoglobin and a ton of other proteins are based on. There's actually an entire class of proteins that are based on heme molecules. So it's very iron rich. It's what makes red meat so red. And red meat is richer in iron than white meat or, you know, pork or something like that. So that we actually know that heme can be metabolized by the cells that line the gut into carcinogenic compounds. And that's potentially what is gradually increasing the risk of cancer. Now, what's interesting about that is that that metabolism is inhibited by chlorophyll. So chlorophyll is what makes plants green. It's the molecule in plants that convert energy from the sun into sugar. And so if you have chlorophyll present, it actually changes how heme is metabolized. And instead of being metabolized into something carcinogenic, it's metabolized into something completely inert. So that's really, really fascinating because it provides a mechanism behind why red meat might increase risk of cancer, but also why vegetable consumption negates that risk. So then the other link is actually a link between some of the proteins, some of the amino acids in red that are particularly rich in red meat, and a protein that is actually produced by gut bacteria. So they produce a protein called TMAO, which is then carcinogenic. And they selectively do that when there's a lot of, I believe, carnitine especially, but there's a few amino acids that they can convert, and different bacteria will convert at different rates. So when you eat a lot of red meat, the bacteria in your gut can produce TMAO. And they've done some really interesting studies where they, you know, give people bacteria and they wipe out the entire gut microflora. And then they look and see if you get TMAO production and then you don't. And so they've really created this link between red meat consumption plus gut microbiome equals higher risk of cancer. But here's what's really interesting, and this is work that, or at least studies that Jeff Leach from the Human Gut Project has like grouped. He's sort of pulled all this information together. And it turns out that the type of bacteria produced in the gut that actually do this conversion from amino acids in red meat to a carcinogenic compound are bacteria that grow preferentially in the guts of people who have grains in their diet. So when you look at the gut microbiome of hunter-gatherers who don't eat grains, they don't have those types of bacteria. So again, it's a, when your diet looks like a paleo diet and it's a meat and vegetable diet, then that mechanism no longer is at play. So there's a third mechanism that is being investigated that is linking red meat consumption to cancer, and that's the new 5G mechanism. So it's, again, it's a protein in red meat. There's a form of it in our bodies that's different than the form in red meat. And it turns out that we can absorb the form that's in red meat into our cells, and it becomes this foreign protein that can then trigger the immune system. We create antibodies against it. And then that somehow, they haven't figured out all the details, may increase risk of cancer, because we know that cancer in many ways is an immune disease. So that one mechanism, no one has looked to see how vegetable consumption may affect it. And so there's no known, you know, interaction there compared to the other two mechanisms. But what's really interesting to understand is immune system dysfunction, of course, is much more likely in someone who's nutrient deficient, because the immune system is such a nutrient hog, right? It's the topic of the paleo approach and like at least 50% of the articles on my blog. So in the context of a nutrient-dense diet, although there's no proof in the scientific literature to show this, we know that when you have nutrient density, you have a lower likelihood of an overstimulated immune system in other illnesses. One could at least hypothesize that in the context of a nutrient-dense paleo diet, that this mechanism also may be moot. But certainly, it's interesting to sort of understand. And it's these mechanisms and where they interact with vegetable intake. Of course, vegetables are very, very high in the best kind of fiber to feed a diverse, healthy microbiome. They're rich in vitamins and minerals that are very bioavailable. For example, the calcium in vegetables is more usable by your body to build strong bones than the calcium in dairy. And they're also really high in a class of antioxidants called phytochemicals. There's thousands of them. We only understand what maybe a couple hundred of them actually do. We know that they have a phenomenal role in reducing oxidative stress in our bodies, in regulating our immune systems, and in preventing the damage associated with or the damage that builds up during aging. So it's, and they also prevent cancer, right? So these antioxidants are really, really important and are generally linked to lower cancer risk. So when we talk about meat and colon cancer risk in the context of a paleo diet, at this point, we don't know if a paleo diet is going to reduce cancer risk. Nobody has studied that yet. But when you start to look at the mechanisms, you can start to tease apart why it's a very, very good hypothesis that the paleo diet would be a diet that would reduce risk of colon cancer. So I thought that would be kind of an interesting thing to talk about before we talk about screening for colon cancer.
I think it's good. I think we allude to that pretty often in some of the other podcasts that we've had, and we've referred to the fact that you did this research and here's the findings. So I think it's good to have a show where we specify that.
Sweet. Let's do some poop questions. Oh, you're feeling uncomfortable again already?
I made a squishy face.
Questions and answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Our first question is from Sue. And Sue says, I went to have my colonoscopy yesterday. The test wasn't completed. I was told I had too much stool still in my colon. I followed all of the instructions that were given to me to the letter. It seems that a paleo diet is more difficult to digest, and I was given a new list of foods I can't have before the next test. I have to go without any raw fruits or vegetables and any large pieces of cooked vegetables for 7 days before the test. Only yogurt, oatmeal, cream soups, and mashed potatoes 3 days before the test. A liquid diet the day before the test, and only colon prep the day of the test. This is going to be very difficult because I've trained myself to eat vegetables with all my meals. I'm sure I can do it, but it seems to go against everything I've learned. Any help making my 7 days more tolerable would be a big help. I love listening to you on my way to work. It's like having two of my friends along for the ride. Keep up the great work.
Why isn't broth mentioned here? Can we just talk about this? Like, only a liquid diet. And then the foods that are listed as only she can have before the liquid diet is yogurt, oatmeal, cream soups, and mashed potatoes. Like, I don't believe it.
They're trying to give foods that, like, a person on a standard American diet would find easy to get and would find relatively filling. Because for 3 days, if you said something sort of less thick and calorie dense, people would find a really, really hard time sticking to it.
Less thick and calorie dense oatmeal? Like, oatmeal is somehow going to be better for her colon? Please explain to me the mechanism, because here's where I'm coming from. I'm already, like, irritated. Knowing what I know about my body's digestive system and how very careful I have to be, I understand why raw vegetables and maybe even fruits could be problematic. What I do not understand is why well-cooked fruits and vegetables, specifically we're talking about something like a pot roast where you cook vegetables and the meat almost all day long. It's pre-digested, it's cooked in broth. That's the sort of thing, or like we've talked about before, seafood, right? A very easy to process protein. Why these things wouldn't be better options than, say, mashed potatoes and oatmeal. Like, I just think of that as, like, clogging my intestines. I can't imagine that being, like, the thing that's going to make it awesome for me to have this thing that I'm not talking about.
Okay. So I think,
and at this point, it's really kind of more for entertainment value.
I want to answer your question and Sue's question together by taking a step backward, which is where Sue says the paleo diet is more difficult to digest. And actually, that's incorrect. So meat and seafood, that protein is far easier for our bodies to digest than the protein from plants. Fruits and vegetables are far easier for our bodies to break down than grains or legumes. And so those foods are actually the most easy to digest foods. Now, that doesn't mean that Sue has great digestion. And there, you know, there may be, you know, I'm guessing there was some discussion with Sue's doctor about why she needed a colonoscopy. And it was either just purely for screening. She's either, you know, hit that age where she's at higher risk and doctors recommend starting a fairly regular screening, or she's got a family history, or she's got symptoms that the doctor wants to have a look. So, and even if she doesn't have symptoms, you know, that doesn't mean there's not something not great about Sue's digestion. And she mentions in her extra info that she's only been paleo for about 6 months. And so, you know, when people say to me that they have trouble digesting, too much stool still in her colon indicates that her digestion is very sluggish. So things that can cause sluggish digestion are things like neurotransmitter imbalances, so not enough melatonin or serotonin, things like not enough insoluble fiber, so a diet that's much heavier on soluble fiber, so more starchy vegetables and less non-starchy vegetables. Low thyroid function can suppress gut motility, gut-brain axis problems. So, having a lot of depression, that suppresses gut motility. Bacterial overgrowth can suppress gut motility because the bacteria in the gut can actually release some chemicals that can control gut motility. So there's a lot of things that could be going on. Insufficient pancreatic secretions, insufficient bile secretions, that can affect gut motility. So there's a lot of different things that can be going on and definitely worthwhile troubleshooting with an integrative or functional medicine specialist. There's supplements that could be taken for a variety of those conditions. And then lifestyle adjuncts like using a squatty potty or a step and go, which are basically stools, or just a regular stool is fine. But the nice thing about these is the way they kind of wrap around the toilet so they can kind of tuck out of your way when you're not using them. But these put your body into a natural squatting position without you actually having to balance on your feet while having a bowel movement. Sorry, Stacey. I know that made you feel squeamish.
I'm good.
So things like that, testing for some of these potential underlying health problems that could be causing sluggish digestion. Even a stool test can look and see if there's some gut dysbiosis stuff happening. So there's a lot of different things that can be going on, and they're all addressable by working with a good healthcare professional. So all of that being said, going back to the problem at hand. So, why she might have still had stool in her colon, I don't think that was blame the paleo diet. I think that was a lot of possible other things that were going on. But Stacey, you're absolutely right. So sticking to like stewed, well-cooked, slow-cooked meats and vegetables. So pot roasts, stews, things that are cooked for a very, very long time, that breaks down the food enormously. And that's definitely the easiest to digest. So if I was a doctor making a recommendation specifically towards making the colon prep more effective, I would be recommending things like soups and stews. I actually don't understand why non-starchy vegetables wouldn't be helpful here unless there's a really big gut dysbiosis problem. So definitely in that case, like cooked non-starchy vegetables, but Like,
we've talked before about how things like kale and broccoli, although they aren't non-starchy, can be difficult for people with non-optimal digestion to digest. So, like, I get how those things, especially raw, would be problematic. But once you cook them thoroughly, they should be extremely easily digestible. Like, that it,
and
it
not
changes
only that, help,
the food.
And help regulate
right.
gut motility. I mean, that's the big advantage to non-starchy vegetables is the insoluble fiber is such a powerful regulator of gut motility. So I mean, to me, that would be an advantage. And then liquid diet before the prep day, like I'm thinking broth, not juice, right? Like, or jello. Like I'm thinking good broth.
Yeah, I've actually seen
homemade gelatin. Like,
yeah, I've seen some paleo people prep for the liquid diet portion and have really smart things like jello and broth. Herbal teas can be good for you. But also, you can make homemade smoothies. You can make, like I've seen some people make popsicles. And technically all you're looking for here is, you know, is it a liquid in the end state? So you don't have to think about it, at least from my understanding. It doesn't necessarily have to be a liquid from the start, right? So it doesn't have to only be broth. Like, I think the point of them wanting you to do liquid is kind of the point that Sarah and I are making about pot roast and soups and stuff, which is that they know that the liquid has been broken down enough that your body is going to more easily digest it. And so you can pretty much liquefy a lot of things. I won't say everything, but
there's
a lot of
things. Difference between a liquid diet and a clear liquid diet. And I think what you're talking about is a liquid diet. And that's what Sue says. She doesn't say clear liquid. Clear liquid really means that there's like, if it
right. That's like water and broth. Yeah.
Water, broth. I mean, jello actually counts. Juice typically counts. And by jello, I hope our listeners understand that we don't actually mean the boxes of jello. We actually mean like get some good quality gel, get some even cheap gelatin and make your own with broth, with herbal tea, with kombucha, with you know, watered down juice or juice mixed with herbal tea. There's a bajillion recipes for that out there. You can even add a lot of gelatin and make them into something like gummy bears, but they're like,
we actually
just
have
gelatin.
You have
a recipe for that.
Well, we have a blog post with a roundup of 60 different gelatin-based foods because we're such big fans.
So there you go.
Yeah.
So we'll link to that post, and then everybody will have everything that they need for a clear liquid diet if they ever need to go on one. So, you know, like, I think that was hopefully enough, like, how to do this more challenging version of the colonoscopy prep and stay within the paleo principles.
So I do feel like we need to have a bit of a disclaimer here, which is that Sue says that her doctor told her to not eat vegetables. And we are suggesting that perhaps you and I would make a different choice, but we are not medical professionals, and Sue and everybody else needs to make their own choices for themselves. We are simply suggesting the mechanism behind why we think a doctor would say certain things and what we would choose to do.
Yeah. And I think the other aspect, I think we're still also within the doctor's recommendations because the doctor said to avoid large pieces of cooked vegetables. So my suggestion there is to chew thoroughly, which sounds facetious, but I mean, it's actually something that I know I have to really work hard to do. I have the natural tendency to inhale my food and not chew it much on the way down. And that's really bad for digestion because in part of it, the smaller we make those pieces of food in our mouths before it goes through the rest of our digestive tracts, the easier it is for all of the enzymes in our body to further break down those foods. But the other aspect is that chewing is a really important signal, and it actually sends signals to the rest of our digestive tract to prepare to digest food. So by chewing food thoroughly, we get a better response with pancreatic enzyme secretion and bile secretion into the small intestine. So chewing is really, really important. And then also, if you're chewing your food, you're not eating the large pieces of cooked vegetables because they're really, really tiny by the time they hit your stomach.
I want to echo my wholehearted endorsement of that statement. One of the most important things I ever learned about my own digestion was listening to a podcast with Rob Wolf years ago. And he talked about the importance of not drinking while you're eating, because often people like half chew and then they drink and slog it down when it's not fully chewed. And it was actually really difficult for me to learn how to give up liquids while I was eating, because I was a huge culprit of that. And it like drastically improved my digestion when I learned how to chew my food. So although it sounds like something silly and perhaps, of course I chew, it's one of those things where, you know, it's rest and digest. And if you're hurrying through your meal and you're not taking your time and you're not thinking through chewing, and, you know, perhaps you're on the go and you're eating in the car and all those things, like your body isn't going to digest it properly. So I just want to wholeheartedly echo what you just said.
One of my favorite Rob Wolf quotes is, "Learn the difference between your mouth and a vacuum cleaner."
It totally sounds like Rob Wolf.
It totally sounds like Rob Wolf. And yet it was one of those things that like I have to remind myself of frequently, because one of the things that happens when I'm eating food so quickly that I'm not chewing it is I'm also not very good at portion control. So it's one of those things that if when I'm mindful to chew my food, I'm also more mindful of how I feel as I'm eating. And I'm much better at eating a reasonable portion for my body compared to my default, which is to overeat. Still, after all these years, yes, I admit it.
Yeah, I'm guilty. Moving on.
Moving on. Our next question is from Ruth. Ruth says, "Hi, I have an upcoming colonoscopy for a couple of reasons. I have some bleeding and there is a family history of colorectal cancer. Both my paternal grandfather and paternal great aunt died from it. Plus, my half-sister had some early polyps and my father has had polyps. I know that everything gets cleaned out beforehand. I'm wondering what I can do to repopulate my gut with good prebiotics and probiotics and bacteria after I am done. I take Saccharomyces boulardii and Dr. O'Hara's probiotics. I'm wondering what more I can do. Thanks."
So I would definitely say, other than the suggestions you can give her about the probiotics that you've had good luck with, that there are a lot of probiotic-rich foods that I would recommend she eat, specifically fermented foods that you can either make yourself or buy pre-purchased. Almost all of my local grocery stores carry some sort of refrigerated probiotic fermented food. If you tolerate dairy, I think the additional information says she's primal. So if she's eating dairy, I would say yogurt and kefir are really good choices for that. Of course, there's kombucha. And those are all of the natural foods that my family eats to get probiotics. And then maybe you could talk about, other than probiotics, how to help the gut along, like broth and liver and all the other things that kind of prime the intestines to accept those probiotics in a happy sort of way.
So first I want to echo your recommendations, because I actually think that probiotic foods, especially wild ferments, so wild fermented sauerkraut or pickle compared to lacto fermented, and it should stay, if you're shopping for that at a local Whole Foods or Sprouts or something like that, it should say on the package if it was made with a starter. If it's made with a starter, it doesn't have the same diversity as a wild ferment. But for example, a wild fermented sauerkraut can have up to, 600 different probiotic strains, whereas, even the best probiotic supplements might have 8 or 9 strains. Maybe you'll find like a crazy one that has 20 strains, but it like has nowhere near the variety that a wild ferment has. So, and then something like kombucha or kefir, and there's also water kefir, which you didn't mention. So that's appropriate even if you are sensitive to dairy. They typically have on the order of like 40 different strains, including some beneficial yeast. So I actually think that the food-based probiotics are always the best choices, except for the situations where people are sensitive to them. The other thing that the probiotic that you can't really get easily from food, well, you can get it easily from food, but it requires you to eat dirty food. So if you're not into eating dirty food, that a soil-based organism can be really, really helpful. I personally take Prescriptassist and have for coming up on 3 years, and love it. So Prescriptassist is the most diverse soil-based organism supplement out there, and the only one that has been tested in clinical trials. So it's definitely the one that I recommend. In terms of prebiotics, you know, in one of the things that happens when you do the colonoscopy prep is you basically wipe out everything. It's a really effective way to deal with bacterial overgrowth really, really quickly, because you wipe out all the contents of the entire digestive tract. Now, there still is bacteria in there. They're just in much lower quantities. So in many ways, like re-inoculating isn't strictly necessary, because as soon as you provide the food for those bacteria, they're going to start growing again. And so that's why, you know, someone can have, you know, a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, doing a colonoscopy, the colonoscopy shows up negative, they go right back to their normal diet, and within a few weeks, they've got all the symptoms back again, because they've, you know, refed all those same bacteria too much all over again. So in terms of prebiotics, you know, the thing to remember is that the numbers of bacteria in the gut have been knocked way down, and they do a really important job for us, which is to help us digest our foods. So it's completely normal to see particles of undigested food in the stool for a week, maybe two at the absolute longest, in your stool after doing a colonoscopy prep. That should, it should diminish pretty quickly. So, you know, the best foods for quickly adjusting the gut bacteria, typically non-starchy vegetables and seafood. This is one of those cases where I'd suggest starting with cooked vegetables, because, and including some starchy vegetables, because soluble fibers are so fermentable. But I would suggest starting with cooked vegetables, because one of the things you want to do is you want to be feeding these bacteria, and getting them to get back to their normal levels so that they can help you digest. So you want to be giving them that fiber, but at the same time, those vegetables are going to be harder to digest because you don't have the bacteria helping you out. So sticking with cooked vegetables, at least for a few days, and starting to slowly add in raw vegetables, keeping an eye on how that makes you feel. And, you know, there's you know, slow and steady wins this race. But the things that I would be looking at is lots of vegetable content, a mix of non-starchy and starchy vegetables, and seafood, because we know that the types of fats that we eat actually has a really dramatic impact on the type of bacteria that like to grow in our gut. And long-chain omega-3s from seafood are the kind that all the good ones like to grow in. So, you know, slow and steady. Like, I have done this prep only once. It was long before my paleo days, and I had been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, which was probably caused by SIBO, although I was never diagnosed. And I loved it. I loved being cleaned out. It was amazing. And I felt great for, well, I didn't feel great during the actual test, but afterwards I felt great for a few weeks. And I think it was really that sort of situation of dealing with an overgrowth, at least temporarily. And I didn't have any issues going back to my normal, pretty terrible diet afterwards. So, so I think that, you know, focusing on cooked foods, you know, especially if there's some bleeding, because that's going to be a little bit more soothing, and lots of broth, which can be really soothing for the gut as well, is going to be sort of the best way back.
All right. I handled it.
You handled it, and kind of a good length show for us. Sweet. I get to go to bed at a good time.
I know, I'm super, super excited. So for those of you who love our longer shows, don't worry, we'll be back next week.
All right, thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites, or by donating through PayPal.
It's TPV EP 139 colonoscopy.
Oh my God! No, we're not.
Yeah, yeah. Colonoscopies.
Why are we talking about poop?
Because is there anything better to talk about than poop?
Oh. Can't we just talk about rainbows and butterflies?
We could, but I actually think it would be far less interesting for our listenership. So this is tangential poop talk. We're actually mostly talking about, like, re-inoculating the gut and gut health and gut healing. That's, like, totally up our alley. We can handle it.
Okay. Make it quick.
We're going to make it quick. Well, this will be the shortest episode ever because Stacey feels uncomfortable talking about poop.
So gross.
There shall be no explosive diarrhea mentioned in this podcast.
You notice that I don't actually refer to it as explosive diarrhea, even when I'm talking about it, because that's inappropriate.
You refer to it, you know what? It is technical. It is a technical term to say explosive diarrhea, as opposed to your everybody out moment. I just used air quotes.
I am going to consider this podcast an opportunity to get some steps in. And you go ahead, talk about